The process today of drafting work instruction involves a manufacturing engineer getting a CAD file over email from a mechanical engineer, pulling it apart part by part, figuring out what order to do all the assembly extremely manually, taking hundreds of screenshots and then throwing them all together into a several hundred page PowerPoint or Word doc over the course of weeks or months.
Wow.
Just agonizing. Mm-hmm. And that is how it is done everywhere.
Hello, I'm Ty Morse. Welcome to Relentless. This is my conversation with Philip Ehrenstein, the founder of Dirac. Dirac is currently focused on automating work instructions. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
How did you come up with the name Dirac?
Right. So funny, the Nobel Prize for quantum mechanics went to three people, Schrodinger, Heisenberg, and Dirac. Mm. Everybody knows Schrodinger and Heisenberg. Nobody knows Dirac, unless you're an electrical engineer or a physicist. In which case, you know him like the back of your hand. Mm. And very similar to the problem that we care about, engineers love building software for other engineers. Nobody really likes to build software for technicians or manufacturing folks that like actually improves their quality of life. And that's what we're doing. So I thought, hey, also really cool name, Dirac. It's actually got some really, really nice symmetry to it. You can actually see by the logo, you can basically take this shape, rotate 90 degrees, rotate another 90 degrees. You can get like really nice symmetry. Mm. It's like a 90 by 90 square. And so it's got that really great symmetry. But also at the time of starting the company, I was reading the biography on Paul Dirac. It's called The World's Strangest Man by Graham Vermello. Really, really great book. And I was like, huh, this guy's awesome. Sleeper. You know, nobody really knows about him. Reminds me exactly of my best friend and now co-founder, Peter. And mm-hmm. I was like, you know what? Very apt. We should definitely name the company after this guy. And that's where it comes from.
That's where it comes
from. So it's partially from the book, from it reminding me of Peter, and from wanting to shed light on a problem that bring light to a name and a problem that like nobody else really cares about.
Yeah. It's like you and your co-founder have known each other for a very long time.
Yeah.
You met in college. What was the first project that you guys worked on together?
That's an interesting question. That's funny. So initially, Peter and I met in this freshman electrical engineering undergrad class. I turned around this class to try to make a friend. Mm-hmm. You know, started chatting with this guy behind me. And it was like, oh, like, where are you from? It's like, oh, New York. No way. Me too. Turns out we grew up 5 minutes away from each other back at home. Neighboring high schools. You know, we competed against each other in mathletes, but we never met. His school used to come to my school and we did mathletes in the cafeteria against each other. He swears he remembers me from that, but I never ran into him. And, so really, really funny coincidence. And basically since then we've been best friends and partners on many an adventure. And the class that I met him in, we had a final project. And the final project, they gave us four options. It was a mastering electronics class. It was it was digital system fundamentals. So like freshman year class, you're like learning about logic gates, really, really interesting stuff. And I noticed that this guy was, you know, just cranking away, just cracked, super, super smart.
He's really good.
He's really, really good. And so that also was kind of the onus of like trying to talk to him. I was like, oh, this really seems like a really smart guy. I like want to get to know him. And for that final project, I was trying to meet some people who were like also working on the same project. There mm-hmm. were four options. They gave us a month to do that final project. In 1 week, Peter did all four options.
Oh, so you just like met this guy that's incredibly talented and like really hardworking, and you're like, this is the guy? I mean,
kind of, yeah.
At least for the project.
Yes. Well, more or less. I met him right before that, and then. Mm-hmm. I saw, like, I just would talk to him every week, and I met him, and I would just ask him about the project, like a couple days later, and I was like, you know, because the class met, like, every other day.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, like, how's it going? He's like, yeah, I just finished another one. I was like, oh, my God. Like, what do you mean you finished another one? He's like, yeah, I finished a second project. I was like, okay, I got to spend more time with this guy. Yeah. And he just really fascinated me because he just seemed different. And I found it very, very interesting. And so that was sort of like when we first started working together. That was in the spring. And I started to kind of like towards like the middle of the spring, like end of spring. This was like end of spring, right? Like a month left in the semester, 2 months left in the semester. Mm-hmm. I would like ask him to like, come over, like, let's do some problem sets. Let's meet in the library. Let's, like, try to work together.
Yeah.
And it was really funny because he, like, he just, like, didn't, he wanted to be, like, left alone. I was like, no, 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 Peter, come on. Like, just meet me in the library. I just kept dragging him. Like, I just kept pulling him. I was like, come on, let's, like, let's hang out. Let's, you know, do problem sets together. And I would just, like, hold on to him. And I would hold on to him. And it got to a point where, like, he would just, like, regularly, like, I would just regularly, like, grab him to, like work with me on stuff. And, like, on problem sets, and we'd do them together. It was really funny because, like, Pete just blazed through everything. Mm. And, like, I, you know, I kind of, like, took my time with some stuff. There's some, like, I don't, it's funny. There's like, a couple of classes where, like, Peter, it's just, the guy is just literally the smartest person I've ever met. Mm. And there were some classes where he would, like, get up and, like, help, like, teach the class with the professor. Like, he was sort of, like, that guy.
Uh-huh.
And I was the guy who, like, I was up all night, like, working on some, like, other stuff unrelated to school. And, you know, I would, like, sleep. I would show up late to class pretty regularly. I would get, like, 2-3 hours of sleep a night. And I would be, like, roughly, like, 5 minutes late to class every morning. I don't know why. It's just weird.
It almost sounds like this, you know, I studied, like, Brian Chesky and Joe Gebbia, and Brian's got this line where he says, you want to be working with co-founders that you're almost intimidated by how good they are.
Yeah.
This kind of sounds like a situation where that would be similar.
Yeah. Like I said, like, Peter, we had friends over at, we didn't go to MIT, but we had friends who were over at MIT, and Peter was the guy who they went to do their math homework for them.
Interesting.
You know, effectively, Peter's probably earned, like, roughly like 8 or 9 degrees.
What?
And just, like, did people's homework for them. He just, like, blew through it.
Okay.
Like, from various schools. Peter and I both have, like, a master's, bachelor's in electrical engineering, and master's in robotics. We figured out a way to, it's funny because you kind of see it now in the company. I, like, planned and he executed. So I'm an optimizer. So, like, I found a way that we can construct our schedules and, like, overlap specific classes with the requirements so that we could actually bang out the electrical engineering undergrad degree in 3 years. And then with, like, overloading a lot.
Yeah.
And then I kind of found this, like, loophole in the master's program where, like, you can kind of overlap some stuff. And they, like, but it wasn't, like, explicitly said. And so I got us to apply for the master's program while we were still in undergrad, before we, like, finished the degree. And they were internal. So it was like, oh, it's like one of those, like, it was like one of those 4+1 programs.
Mm.
But, like, you can only do that if you overload and you take extra classes and you try to, like, double count. But because we finished the undergrad degree in 3 years, we started to, and we were still overloading, you had to get the registrar to, like, sign off on it anyway. So we kind of, like, got them to accidentally sign off on two things, which was overloading and also taking master's classes.
Oh, really?
So, but they didn't realize. And so they actually signed off on us taking, in our senior year, all of the master's classes while still being undergrads. So at the end of the 4 years, we basically also squeezed, like, the master's degree for robotics into, like, 1 year. Wow. Like, overloaded on, like, grad classes, which they additionally did not want you to do. They, like, max of 3 classes. You're not supposed to take a fourth. We did 4 and 4. And so in the fall and spring. And so at the end of it, we actually had 2 graduation ceremonies, like, back to back. We actually got our master's degrees before we got our bachelor's degrees.
Really?
It's kind of funny. Yeah. So, because the grad degree graduation ceremony was, like, 2 or 3 days before the undergrad. So for, like, 2 or 3 days, we just only had master's degrees. It's kind of funny. So that was just kind of, like, a neat thing. So, like, I kind of planned, like, that, and, like, the gerrymandering of, like, the schedule and the structure of it. And yeah, like, Peter executed, but yeah. I mean, like, I obviously, like, did my homework and stuff and, like, took my own tests, but, like, I certainly,
he carried,
like,
you a little bit.
Peter carried me a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we were also trying to do startup stuff at the same time.
Yeah. So what else were you doing? Like, I mean, you said 3 hours of sleep, which is so ridiculous, but
what kind of startups
were you doing?
First idea that Peter and I had, for a startup was in sophomore year. We wanted to build the 21st century update to the pill bottle. So still have the CAD files for it. It was essentially supposed to be fingerprint activated, only dispensed according to your prescription.
Oh.
And so the goal was to essentially combat the opioid epidemic. So a little bit of a personal reason for this. my uncle, he was battling cancer, and it was that May. So like the May before sophomore year. And he was prescribed opioids for, for killing the pain for some of his cancer treatment. Mm-hmm. And he had taken some of these opioids one too many, too close to each other. And he, while he was going up the stairs, he had, passed out. And he fell down the stairs. And a couple of days later, he died. And that felt really, shitty. Stupid. It just felt fucking dumb.
Yeah.
Felt really dumb because, why? There's, so much control over, over opioids, right? So much control from when it's made to when it's put into somebody's bottle. And then there's no last mile control whatsoever to stop people from dying accidentally. So that felt really dumb. And I was talking to my dad about it. And I was talking to Peter about it. And I was like, it was you could solve this. This is actually, there's something to be done in here. So we still have the CAD files where I don't think there's anything like it even to this day. At some point we might just sell the design.
Yeah.
But basically it was you had a controlling system with a motor. You had a case and a cartridge. And it's the densest way you can pack. We never filed a patent or anything, but totally could have. We didn't know how patents worked. And we were working on that for a while. So we catted it up, we did the electronics for it, got a little bit of a prototype going. Actually in my backpack, I actually carry around with me, the 3D printed models of it to this day.
Do you want to go grab that?
Yeah.
Let's grab that. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. You can kind of, I always hear it when I'm walking around, I can actually always hear the jingle. Mm-hmm. I've got here. Yeah.
Awesome.
Here. It's different versions, different iterations. It's roughly like this.
Okay.
See, this is a high resolution printer. And then these were sort of these dials.
Interesting.
This was 4 or 5 years ago. I've been carrying these around with me for four or five years. Yeah.
What made you decide to stop working on it?
Couple things. COVID hit. Uh-huh. COVID hit, and we were trying to talk to NIDA, the National Institute for Drug Administration, and we were trying to talk to somebody about doing some sort of pilot.
Yeah.
And basically when COVID hit, everybody stopped answering our emails and everything went completely dark. Okay. We couldn't talk to anybody there anymore. All the resources were galvanized towards, COVID, so...
So it just put you at a standstill and you decided to move on?
Yeah. To this day, we still have the CAD files, right? We still file the patents. We still
build. And you're literally carrying around in your backpack for years, which is...
Wow. So the way... I won't describe how it works, but it's kind of cool. I'll share off camera, but...
Okay.
Just because it's IP, technically. If we ever,
decide to do something with it.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
Yeah, somebody should. I would love to give it to somebody.
Do you know how many people die every year from mistreatment of millions?
Yeah.
Okay.
Rough. I think the number, if I'm recalling correctly, there's one number that's 600,000 and one number that's 3 million.
And what do you...
Opioid so I imagine deaths, that there's... I think it's... mistiming of prescription-related deaths. I think that's something like 600,000, maybe. And then opioid-related deaths in general, I think that's 3 million.
Jesus. Wow.
Yeah.
And that's wild. What did you decide to work on after that, after you decided to move on from the pill bottle?
So there was sort of a long... Worked on a lot of different things. I, at the time, was also doing brain-computer interfacing research. Mm-hmm. So that was why I was at Hopkins. When I was 16, I really wanted to do brain-computer interfacing research. I wanted to start my own brain-computer interfacing company. I basically was deeply fascinated by the concept of consciousness. I thought the final frontier... originally, I wanted to be an aerospace engineer. I wanted to work at Tesla. Not Tesla. I wanted to work at SpaceX. Mm-hmm. When I was, 10 or 11. Actually, it's funny. I made my Twitter account when I was like 13. It was like 2013, right?
Yeah.
2013 and 2014. I was still 13. I made my Twitter account specifically so I could tweet at Elon. Because like I was like 12. I knew who he was.
Yeah.
Back in 2012, because I was like obsessed with, I wanted to be like a spaceship designer. That was like I didn't know what it was called. I wanted to be like an inventor, a spaceship designer.
Yeah.
I had heard about Elon because I saw this meme that like compared him to like Tony Stark. And before that, I was like, I gotta be like Tony Stark. That's the guy. And so I heard about Elon. I was like, oh, it was like a stat page. It was like Elon, Tony. It's like the real life Tony. And I was like, ah, yes. Like that's me.
So Tony just Stark like me was your role model when you were younger.
Yes. From when I was 7. I had a very thick Marvel Cinematic Universe biography book.
Really?
When I was 7. And in there, you flip to Tony Stark's page and you see like, where did you go to school? He went to MIT. He only had a master's in electrical engineering. He got it when he was 19. And so no bachelor's, mm-hmm. but he had a master's in electrical engineering from MIT when he was 19. And like born where? It just said Long Island, New York. And I was like, yeah, just like me. I was like,
so did you just like use this as your role model and you did you get the degree because of Tony Stark?
I did think, you know, it's funny, like kind of, yeah.
It's hilarious.
Yeah. I was like, that's the degree to get. Yeah. Cause like, you know, it's yeah. Basically I think it's funny, like after the fact, like realizing it, like, yeah, I guess so. It was really that I started to understand that like, I wanted to have a really far breadth of engineering experience mm-hmm. and understanding. And I started to look at, I was kind of leaning towards like biomedical engineering because I'm sort of like dancing around like timelines here, but yeah. I was leaning towards biomedical engineering. But then I sort of began to understand like if you're a BME, you're kind of like a jack of all trades, master of none. They're not like really good programs in general. But as an electrical engineer, there's like a lot of things you could self-teach in engineering. You could self-teach like mechanical engineering, I think. You can self-teach computer science, certainly. Like you can absolutely teach yourself how to do software.
There's also a whole bunch of like free courses that are available, so it's not a problem.
So I was like, why am I going to waste my time getting a degree in CS? Mm-hmm. I actually kind of had like a little bit of a deep resentment for like software engineers. I don't know why. Well, I do know why.
Why?
Longer story.
Okay.
I just like I've very much valued people who like built like physical things.
Products, yeah.
And I was like, I guess resentful of the fact that software engineers got paid like 1.5 times as much as electrical engineers and mechanical engineers. I was like, why? Does it make any sense? So I guess throughout college, I mean, growing up and throughout college, I just like was like, you know, like fuck software engineers. Like those guys suck. Now we run a software company, ironically. However, we do call ourselves the anti-software company. Because everybody in the team has a hardware background and has pivoted their career into software and taught themselves how to code. And I'll get more into that later, but like the team is so awesome. Very, very, very lucky.
Is that something that you actually like filter for?
Yes,
people
explicitly.
That are, explicitly?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, what is your flow of how you actually decide to hire someone? Where do you find, because I know that X is an important part of your life. At least I think so.
It's funny. Twitter is great. I don't know why we call it X. It's amazing.
Because Elon.
Twitter. I love them, but like it's just Twitter. There are explicitly 4 things we hire for. I have like a 3-round interview process. We're like starting to modify this to make it like a little less, you know, like I guess a little more rigorous. Mm. It is 4 things. You have to be based, aligned, American values in mind. You have to know who we're building for and why. And you have to be on the right side. You have to be like extremely competent. You have to be willing to be in person in New York, but now in El Segundo, so you can pick a place. And you have to have a hardware background, but pivot into software. Because software engineers who are pure software engineers, very frequently with no hardware experience, don't understand, they don't have like a mental framework for understanding the discrepancy between simulation and reality. And that is the gap we're trying to close at Dirac. So if you've never built anything in the real world, if you've never been to a factory, if you've never worked with your hands, you don't actually have a mental framework for understanding the gap we're trying to close. And frequently, you don't care about it either. Mm-hmm. So we explicitly filter for people who know and care. If you don't know and you don't care, you know, do you really want to work with us anyway? So that's our mentality.
Yeah. And are you guys, when I was researching for this, I heard you say something along the lines of, basically people will design things, and then by the time that someone's actually like creating it in the real world, the design doesn't work, or like things don't fit together,
yeah,
something like that.
Very, very frequently. So before the 1970s, engineers and manufacturers were connected by one thing, mm-hmm, and that was the blueprint. Classic cyanotype blueprint that you imagine in your head when you say blueprint.
Yeah.
And in like the late 70s, early 80s, CAD software emerged and became ubiquitous. And yeah, so all the mechanical engineers who were living on the shop floor, well integrated into production, they actually like knew how things fit together in the real world. They were blue collar. They were all relegated to the back office and went from being blue collar to white collar. And basically since then, mechanical design has been completely divorced from reality. You've got mechanical engineers coming out of school, you know, never having been to a, you know, a shop floor, designing systems 5,000 miles away from where they're actually built, mm-hmm, frequently designing systems that are not actually manufacturable. Because,
and what does that mean, not actually manufacturable?
You can design, so, and this is the problem with CAD software writ large. CAD software, most design software, looks at things from the top-down platonic ideals of solids perspective, like the top-down engineering perspective. And so you can have a CAD environment that does not like reflect reality, that does not mimic something that is actually physically possible. I can CAD something up. I can CAD a closed box and put something inside of it and it not actually be like assemblable. Mm-hmm. And then frequently people will CAD things up, and this has been happening for the past 25 years. People will CAD things up, send those CAD files to the shop floor. They'll send them to a manufacturing engineer will try to throw together work instructions. They might not catch it. They'll throw those work instructions together, send it to the shop floor, and some technician will be like following the work instructions, trying, yep, to put the thing together for the first time. And they'll be like, I can't fit my hand into this little nook to torque this bolt. You know, you guys gotta move this part back a little bit. And they'll find that out like 18 months later. And so they'll try to surface that design feedback back to the mechanical engineer who designed the thing. By the time they get that back to the guy who designed it, it doesn't work there anymore. Mm-hmm. So like that is a monumental problem. It's this design for manufacturability problem where you have no context for the real world. So how are you gonna, you know, design something to be actually manufacturable without having that context? So like that is actually viscerally at its core the problem that we're trying to solve at Dirac.
Yeah.
We think that context is king. So we're, you know, automatically generating assembly work instructions with just your CAD file. But really what we're also being is this data aggregation platform for manufacturability information and tribal knowledge around how things actually fit together in the real world, mm-hmm, both being a data aggregation platform for it and a knowledge like dissemination platform. So you can surface that across your entire manufacturing engineering team. But really what we want to do with that information is we actually want to bring it earlier into your mechanical design process. So we actually want to take all that information within the context of your mechanical design and then bring it earlier into your mechanical design software. Then eventually, we're actually going to build our own mechanical design software specifically focused on assembly with manufacturability built into the core of it. Understanding that these aren't just some, you know, dumb set of parts. These are, you know, we understand like this isn't just like a couple of dumb solids sliding around each other. This, mm-hmm, is, you know, this is a nut and this is a bolt and this is this specific nut and this specific bolt. And we actually have an understanding of how they relate to each other. And it's just context. That's what we're aggregating. It's just context.
Are you trying to like, so I remember reading about a company that would, every time someone gave someone an order or instruction, you had to provide the why behind the order or instruction, or else, you know, if you didn't do it twice, you'd be fired. And so basically it was like, they wanted to make sure that people understood why they were doing a thing. And so you, didn't have a situation where someone just did it for the sake of like doing it in the past, right? Is that, so you said you're kind of providing context across, like even if someone leaves, then people in the future at the same company will understand why that person did what they're doing, yes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, chronologically, information with a conversation around it is the context we want to be able to preserve. So understanding why did somebody select this torque spec? Why did somebody say to grease this or Loctite that? And be able to preserve that information within the context of the instruction is where we like seek to like aggregate that information. There's also a lot more to it. There's a lot of things that we have not figured out. There are better ways to collect that information. what we do right now is like you can add notes and you can add tools and we will automatically associate those like bits and pieces of information with specific components over time. So the next time you drop in an assembly and it's a part that you've seen before, we will automatically populate your instructions with the information that you added last time. So if you added a torque spec to a specific, you know, bolt, we will automatically populate the next instruction that you the next instruction that you generate with that bolt with that torque spec. And so like that sort of extrapolates to tools as well. It's, and yeah, that's basically what we end up propagating. So that's like V0 of it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of other stuff that we're looking at aggregating over time. Yeah, that's sort of
I did see something called a true print on your website. What is a true print? Because that's like this final form of your company. What is that?
That is the mechanical design software with manufacturability built into the core of it. Our goal, basically what happened when CAD software emerged, basically took the blueprint and it fractured it into two parts. CAD software on the design side and work instructions on the build side. CAD software's gotten all the upgrades for the past 50 years, and work instructions never have. It's literally, people are, the process today of drafting work instruction involves a manufacturing engineer getting a CAD file over email from a mechanical engineer, pulling it apart part by part, figuring out what order to do all the assembly extremely manually, taking hundreds of screenshots, and then throwing them all together into a several hundred page PowerPoint or Word doc over the course of weeks or months.
Wow.
Just agonizing. Mm-hmm. And that is how it is done everywhere. You know, you ask any manufacturing engineer at any company of any scale, and that is how they do it. There's one or two pieces of software out there that, you know, basically look like PowerPoint with a couple of extra buttons, and they sometimes use that, but it's basically the same workflow, and people are not happy with those softwares either. So we are looking to automate the majority of the grunt work of that process. So we are essentially trying to build the 21st century update to the work instruction, and then basically bring CAD software and work instructions closer and closer together until we reunite the blueprint. We want to bring manufacturability back to mechanical design, and we think we can do that by bringing these guys closer together and reuniting them into one platform with manufacturability built into the core of it.
What kind of efficiency gains do you think that you'll get from doing this?
It's kind of tough to quantify. Imagine being able to get a product to market significantly faster, not having to do as many redesigns because, you know, you don't have to worry about something you're building not being manufacturable. What we've seen is, and what we're looking to get out of, or what we're looking to offer our users, is at least an order of magnitude speed up in the process of drafting work instructions. We've actually got a little bit of an anecdote actually from our first ever customer, Southwest Antennas. Incredible team. I love Southwest Antennas. Big shout out to them. They are the best antennas you could ever get, period, bar none. They are a tier one, tier two supplier of antennas based out in Poway, it's in San Diego, down in California. And they make 2,000 different types of antenna. Incredibly awesome company. They have a head of engineering over there named Chris. Chris is a badass. Chris is the best. I love Chris. So he was the one who brought us in, and now that they've, you know, as they've been onboarded and as they started to use the product, Chris actually brought in somebody else from a different part of the organization in to be sort of, he said his document czar, the person in charge of using our software.
So there's a new position being created just for you guys.
Effectively. Okay. It was just somebody who's, I mean, usually it's a manufacturing engineer, but you know, he brought in somebody else from the other facility, from a different part of the facility, to be in charge of using our software for their work instructions. And she was able, you know, she's junior, not really much CAD experience herself. She's really smart, but, you know, not as experienced as Chris, right? Mm-hmm. Chris, you know, head of engineering, been at the company for like 5, 6, 7 years. And so she was basically able to get from zero to completed a 65-page, really complex assembly work instruction in just 4 days. And Chris said it would have taken him 4 weeks to do by hand.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So like that's what we're looking to do basically.
That's a massive efficiency gain. Yeah.
Yeah. You can bring in less skilled people and still have them save an order of magnitude of time drafting their work instructions.
So you guys did not initially start with this idea. My understanding is this was basically like in-house software that you were yes. trying to build like a factory or like a manufacturing place. Yep. Okay, tell me about this. Yes.
So we started, basically what we initially went out to do when I was at Northrop, I saw, unfortunately, how archaic a lot of the infrastructure was on the manufacturing side of things, of what to me seemed like the most advanced companies in the world and the engineering side of things. And we initially wanted to bring automotive level automation to aerospace. We wanted to build the aerospace factory of the future. And we basically said, okay, look, and I can explain a little bit more like the logic and the math. It actually still believe in it, still would make sense. We initially went out to go essentially build this robotic assembly facility. We wanted to do robotic assembly for aerospace systems at scale. And essentially, I'll sort of explain thinking around this. Basically, what we observed was this phenomenon that we called the middle volume valley of death, where for the past like 40, 50 years, aerospace manufacturers would sort of fall into this volume category, where basically more than 100 units is too many to do by hand. Fewer than 10,000 units isn't really enough to justify automating economically, nor is it enough to get the attention of like the massive contract manufacturers like Flex or Jabil. And so when you fall into the middle of volume value of death, what ends up happening is you either run out of money and die, or you get rolled up and acquired. And that is where we basically thought the consolidation that we've seen in aerospace has happened, and what has in the past 40 years led to the formation of the primes. And so we said, okay, what if we can shepherd manufacturing companies through the middle volume valley of death? So we said, okay, let's start with one archetype of a system. Let's say a drone, quadcopter, you know, smaller than a cubic meter. And let's say we, you know, basically built a flexible enough robotic assembly system where we can take 10 to 15 of these low to medium volume contracts, stack them up, call them 10 contracts in a trench coat, where, you know, they essentially look the same. Stage an assembly line for these, you know, for these contracts, and essentially take this 10 contracts in a trench coat and put them down the same assembly line and essentially artificially induce economies of scale. That was the plan. We thought if you can handle enough variance, but stage your process of assembly, like generally in the way that like these systems will all kind of look the same, then you can handle all that variance and you can essentially, artificially induce economies of scale. So that was the plan. We, you know, recognized like, okay, if you're handling a lot of different mix, you don't want to constantly replan all the path planning for all the robotic arms. So we're like, okay, like, let's see if we can just like figure out how to throw in a CAD file and have it automatically figure out what order to do the assembly in and automatically do the path planning too. And so that was like a core piece of software. And we had like a little bit of a demo for it. It was like a nut and a bolt, like a nut being inserted into a bolt. And we went to like 90 aerospace manufacturers over the course of 6 months. And we were like, hey, you guys want to like give us some LOIs, like contract your assembly out to us? And they basically all said like, one, like, who are you? Like, what are you talking about? And they basically all said, you know, the factory seems kind of cool, but that software you mentioned that's under the hood, that's figuring out what order to all the assembly and planning all of that for you, that would actually be game changing for our guys on the floor today. Can we have it? And, you know, for the first couple of months, I pushed back. I was like, no, you know, we're doing the factory. You know, it's fully committed. We're not selling the software. Then at a certain point, we were like, okay, maybe we just kept hearing it over and over again. We were like, okay, maybe we should actually sell the software.
And at what point, like you say you talked to 90 different organizations, yes?
Yeah.
Okay. At what point were you starting to think, maybe we're going in the wrong direction? Maybe we should sell the thing that they want to buy?
I still don't believe that. No. I think it was actually there was one pivotal moment where I was talking to a lead manufacturing engineer over at Astra. I can actually this was over Twitter. I can actually read the text.
Okay.
By the way, his name is NATO, Nathan Sychek from a company called Longshot Space. They're awesome. They're very, very cool. So NATO was a lead manufacturing engineer over at Astra. And I basically posted on Twitter saying, hey, does anybody have any CAD files that we can use? We're trying to test out some software that we're building. And NATO reached out and he's like, here's some CAD files. Like, what do you need them for? And I said, we're working on some software for the factory we're building. The goal of the software is to basically generate assembly instructions and relationships between parts in a CAD file just from the file itself with minimal hard coding. And he said, I want a hard eyes emoji that. That would have been really, really helpful in my last role, which is lead manufacturing engineer over at Astra. We literally spent hundreds of man hours on contract engineers / technical writers to make assembly instructions for technicians to follow. Even getting approximately 90% correct instructions that just needed some tweaks and corrections would have been amazing. I wish you luck in your venture. Mm-hmm. NATO's awesome.
That was a huge vote of confidence.
Yeah, at that point I was like, can we talk? I was like, I want to hear more about this. Like, okay, maybe there's a there. And we talked, and we spent like 2-3 hours talking. And then I basically went back to, you know, I emailed, I think like 45 or 50 of the manufacturing folks that we spoke to.
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, like, we're thinking about a little bit of a change of pace, you know, akin to some discussions that we've had. Can we like find some time like the next week or two to just like throw an idea at you? And they were like, yeah, they like 20 of them said like, yeah, let's do it. So basically I went to a bunch of these guys and I was like, hey, like, what do you think? We're going to rip the software out and just like give it to you guys. Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah, that sounds awesome. Like, let me know. Like, and I'm a hardware guy. So mm-hmm. like, I know like LOIs. I don't know. Like at the time I didn't know like SaaS contracts. So I thought like LOIs were the thing. So, I went to all these guys and I was like, hey, like, can you sign an LOI for like some software? And they were like, yeah, sure. So I got like a bunch of LOIs and I was like, yeah, we got it, guys. And, yeah, and then I like tore up the LOIs because there was like, you don't do that in software, apparently. I was talking to like one of our angel investors. And yeah, basically that catalyzed the kickoff. We were able to raise like a 300K angel check or like a
pre-seed?
Not really, like an institutional check, 300K from Dan Rumenik from Air Angels, the best. Dan is the reason we're able to do this today. Dan is awesome. I cannot thank Dan enough for taking
would,
a chance.
Would this not be around if he hadn't written you the check?
Yeah, probably not. Really? Dan and I were getting dinner last night, and I was telling him, he took the real bet on us because we had nothing. I was not at Northrop anymore. I had like quit to like do this full time, and Peter's actually still at Amazon. but like we didn't have, there was like no real IP built honestly at the time. So Dan like wrote the 300K angel check. I met him on a Monday. He said he's interested on Tuesday. Wednesday, we signed the safe note. Thursday wired, Friday in the bank.
So just an incredible like investor.
Just like that. And you know what's really funny? That is actually 1 year ago exactly to this day.
Really?
Yeah. Isn't that crazy?
That's wild.
Times are, man.
You're moving really fast, you know.
Life has been very, very fun. I am incredibly lucky to have an incredible amount of people who support me and support us, who have believed in us, who have helped us along the way, who took chances on us, like pure chance. And I've just been fortunate to be able to do what we do. And it's I wake up every morning. And I'm excited about how the next day is just going to be better than the last. And I love life. Yeah. Life is just incredible.
Yeah. When we think about that first, so my understanding is when you guys decided to finally go into doing the software, you throw up a form on your website. Like, this is the most MVP thing. Like, you just throw up a form and see the interest. And within 48 hours, you got 110.
So this was a little bit of a time skip. Uh-huh. We were able to do we raised the 300K. Peter quit his job at his Amazon. I like called Peter up like the day the money hit the bank. I was like, Peter, it's time to quit your job. We're doing it. So Peter quit, and then we just started building. Actually, I spent it's really, really fun. Augustus and I, Augustus Dorico, founder of Rainmaker. He's my best friend. We spent 2 months, roughly 2 months, like month and a half on the road together. Another guy, Cam Hardaway, incredible guy, took a bet on Augustus and I just because he wants to help. Because we have aligned values. Cam wants to make America better, and we do too. Yeah. And Cam introduced us to a bunch of awesome people. And so we had a bunch of people we wanted to meet. I wanted to go do more customer discovery. This is like March and April. And so basically Augustus and I, we call it the Great Based American Tour. We hit six cities. I hit 35 facilities in six cities over the course of like roughly 2 months. And also just like kind of fundraising along the way. It was like, hey, we're raising a seed round or something. I don't know. You know, and sort of like sharpening my skills.
This is not like super professional. This is like the first time you're going out and raising money.
There's so many funny. Yeah, it was really, really funny. There was a moment. So Cam had introduced Augustus and I to a family office. Awesome guys in Dallas. I won't mention their name, but incredible, incredible guys. And we, Augustus and I, two different companies, right? Augustus is talking to farmers at the time. He's also fundraising, and I'm doing the same. I'm visiting factories and trying to talk to customers to get, like, you know, it, not LOIs, but, like, get, like, design partners and, like, early customers for, like, you know, Peter's at home. Peter's cranking out code, you know, and I'm out trying to find customers. We go into this family office. The elevator had, like, paintings in it. You know what I mean? Like it was like
that level of affluence.
Literally, it was like Dallas
oil money.
Probably. I think. Incredibly, incredibly great guys. We sit down at this table, Augustus and I next to each other, across these two, you know, fellas, you know, like probably mid-40s, like early 50s. Probably like real estate investment, like billion-dollar real estate investment, like type guys. And we sit down like, I'm doing Dirac. We're automating assembly instructions for manufacturers. And, you know, I give the pitch, and then the guys ask, so you guys are co-founders? And I was like, no, we're doing two different companies. And they're like, oh, okay. For future reference, don't do that. Like, don't go into meetings together. Like, why are you guys? She's like, definitely not. I was like wearing a polo. Augustus was wearing a Hawaiian shirt. We're just like, he's got the mullet. He's got the sneakers. We're just like, I'm just kicking it. And like, I go, and then Augustus pitches, and they're like, yeah, guys, like, cool. For future reference, don't do this. You should like do this individually. And also, like, what we can write you like a $500 million check for some massive real estate development. But like, we don't
do startups.
They were like, we don't do 500K checks. Like, we don't do anything less than like 50 million. So like, let us know when you do that. But like, until then, it's nice meeting you. Awesome, awesome guys. And like, just like funny experiences like that.
Do you have any other crazy stories that are, no, you haven't told before?
That one is one I tell sometimes. Augustus and I have some fun stories. Some just like between us, just to like have fun and reflect on. It's been really, really fun. Life is blessed.
Yes.
Yeah. Some stories best left unshared.
That's all good.
Just to, you know,
on a slightly different note, I know that Isaac Asimov and the Foundation series had some impact on you guys, or influence on you guys deciding to, to build this company. What influence did Isaac Asimov have on your thinking?
So at the time of starting Dirac, Peter and I were both, reading Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, and I was over at Northrop, and I was seeing how all these aerospace systems were, you know, being assembled entirely by hand, very, very manually and artisanally. And we're reading the book series, and we're talking about it. Peter was over at Amazon, and we were talking about how, you know, here is humanity today, artisanally crafted spaceships, and here's humanity 25,000 years in the future, sending a million ships into the stars. How do we get from here to there? And we thought, well, like, we have to start doing what we do in automotive. You have to start mass production. You know, high volume, low cost, mass. And that is the only way we can actually send humanity into the stars. So that was the mentality. We like the Foundation series a lot. For a lot of different reasons. We're actually thinking about different like naming conventions for our software internally, like even different like versions, you know, like Ross's robotics operating system. It's it's a communication protocol effectively for how different, for how you would have different robotic systems like connected up to each other and communicating. They have a naming convention where the name releases after like turtles. We were like, okay, like, what if we named our releases after like Asimov characters?
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, really, really love the Asimov books. Peter also read like all of the like short stories as well. And I haven't gotten around to them, but if you ever want to know more about Asimov, Peter is your guy.
Peter's the
guy. Peter's, well, I mean, Peter's your guy for a lot of things. You know what I mean? Peter also loves, nah, I shouldn't get it.
Go for it.
Peter loves musicals. Really, really loves musicals. If you ask him about like any music, he can like pick the, he, like, knows the composer from like that time that they perform. Like, he's got it. He's got it locked. Peter's got a spectacular dome. Very, very lucky.
Sorry. Who was the first customer that you were able to actually onboard and started paying? Because I know this is like
Southwest Antennas.
The Southwest Antennas.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what does it look like since you started, you get your first customer? How has the growth look like? And what's the like levers that you pull on to make it grow? I saw that you do like these 30 to 45 minute calls with every prospective customer. Is that right?
Yes. Where'd you see that?
I don't know. I found true. It somewhere. Did you, but I was like,
this you have, is a, did you look at my calendar?
No, no. But, I think you may have done it in a different interview, but I was like, I don't know of very many founders that are spending like, that's like 3 or 4 calls per day. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're doing
probably more sometimes.
More.
Yeah.
So you're talking with customers for like 2 to 3 hours or more a day.
I would rather be doing anything else.
That's okay. What is your philosophy for like communicating with customers and taking customer feedback and stuff like that? That's rare. I don't think many founders do that.
I love the people we build for. I find it incredibly, incredibly insightful to spend a lot of time with them. I love to understand like what their lives are like and become like very good friends with them. So like we've got, for example, like we've got like a user over at Stanley Black & Decker. You know, he, awesome guy, and he texts me, you know, like he'll, like we're like, he texts me every day, every other day, like feedback about the product. And we have a Slack channel and he gives feedback in there too. But like, you know, he's like, how do I do this? And I'm like, I just like text him. And I'm like, yeah, it's like, this is how you use it. That's the kind of relationship I want to have with all the people that we built for. Like, I would love to be as involved as possible. Unfortunately, like now I'm kind of feeling the pain of like not being able to be as actively involved in like the relationship. And I mean, I still am. We're getting to this point where basically it's been kind of crazy. We sort of like early customers, early users. And at the end of January, we decided to put out like a $2,000 a month, like LinkedIn ad, where it's just like a part of it is like just the GIF of like a ball valve with like bolts going into holes, or actually nuts going onto bolts, and it's just rotating. This is like an old GIF of mine that I made. And it's like work instructions automated, and then the GIF just kind of rotating. And $2,000 a month LinkedIn ad. And basically since then, we have had an enormous amount of inbound from like several multinational corporations.
Really?
Yeah. I would love to like, ordinarily I love like rattling off like the names of stuff. I can't due to like you know, NDAs and whatnot.
That's
but
fine.
There are some really, really awesome companies.
And so but the other thing is like if you're getting these people to reach out to you from a $2,000 GIF LinkedIn ad.
Yeah.
Clearly ROI. This is a problem that like other people are experiencing. And
I get probably once a day or every other day, somebody will message me on LinkedIn telling me about how awful work instructions are for them and how excited they are about what we're building, which to me is like the most awesome thing ever. I could actually, like literally I'm thinking about one right now. I can read it to you. Yes. This was on Sunday. This guy reaches out. Awesome guy. He works at a, I'm going to leave the specific name out, but he works at a ship maker, a shipbuilder, a boat manufacturer. And he says, "Hey, Philip, came across your company watching a video on YouTube, the S3 video. You guys are doing really interesting work, something software companies like Dassault and Siemens have always brushed to the side. Looking forward to seeing where you guys take it." And I said, "Thanks a ton. Really appreciate that." And he said, then he responded to that, "So we use Solid Edge, and because of how painful it is to do documentation/assembly instructions and the nature of our work, we tend not to do it."
Really?
Yeah. I would say a part of it is the skill level of our guys and custom work we do. But if there was a more intuitive, easier way to make it happen, I would certainly budget for it in every project, as I think it would help a lot with overall communications and engineering involvement with the shop floor. Although companies like Siemens love to brag about it, their software is still super basic and difficult to pull off, similar to how you explained in that video. You're basically doing everything manually, so no one wants to do it." And like, yeah.
When it gives the difficulty of doing the right thing is so hard that people are just abdicating, like they're just not doing it.
Yeah. It's funny. Wild. Then he actually sent me a photo of he sent me a photo of one of the work instructions, and it looks like an IKEA assembly instruction, but like really like just like a screenshot and like some bullet points.
That's wild.
Yeah.
How do you, so you are very particular about who you hire. How do you keep, you know, what kind of culture are you trying to build? And then like, how do you keep the culture?
This is a very, very tough question that I'm still trying to figure out, actually. I've asked some really, really good people about this. And I actually had a really great conversation about this 2 days ago with somebody we're talking to on the investment side. And I asked him this question because this is something I'm actively thinking about. Because culture to me, I love to build culture in a team. And it's really, really important to me to be able to preserve that and keep the bar extremely high for the folks that you bring on. But, you know, I was kind of asking him, like, at what point, because this guy has scaled organizations into, you know, billion-dollar organizations with, you know, tens of thousands of people from zero. I asked him, at what point do you realize that you no longer have control of that? Or, like, how can you not lose control of that? And I think the answer is you have to make sure that in the beginning you're only hiring AAA players. And as you hire AAA players, you have to make sure that you give people a comfortable out. You have to make people understand and know that if somebody is, you know, not a AAA player, if somebody's a B player, it's okay to come to you and tell you. It's okay to make that known because they should feel comfortable understanding that you will take care of them on the way out. So be extremely, extremely generous with people on the way out. And I've been thinking about that a lot lately because it's really, really interesting. Because what you don't want is you don't want AAA players protecting somebody who's like not really on the ball.
Yeah.
Because they're afraid that if they sort of speak up about it and point it out that, you know, they'll be kicked to the curb and they're not going to be able to pay their mortgage and their, you know, their life is over. You want them to have an off ramp.
Yeah.
And that advice translates into a lot of other places. Translates into a lot of other places. You want people to feel comfortable taking the out because if you don't, then it results in a lot of decisions being made, unfortunately, way too late. So that's something that you will regret and look back on is making those sorts of decisions too late.
I imagine for all the companies down here have like very, very strong missions. Like if you don't build, like with Rainmaker, if Augustus doesn't build Rainmaker, I don't think anyone's building Rainmaker, you know, might be the same thing with this company. When you're selecting for, you know, not talking about actual investors investing, but like when you're selecting for investors and you're thinking about what do I want these people to do for me or help me, how do you select? How do you think about that?
So I look at the folks who work with on the capital side as partners, and I put them under the same scrutiny that I do for folks that I hire. You know, based on line American values in mind, highly competent, you know, in person is like a little bit of like a, you know, that's where it sort of differs. And, you know, harder background, most investors do not, they've never been to a factory. So it's a little bit tougher for those, but at least you have to be mission aligned. You have to know and you have to care.
You just got to give a shit.
You just have to give a shit. Exactly. So that's sort of the table stakes. And then really what I evaluate is I love to stand on the shoulders of giants. I realize there's a lot of playbook stuff out there that I don't have to reinvent. There's stuff that I do want to reinvent, but there's stuff that I don't think I have to and I shouldn't. And so I love learning from people who have been there and done that and are able to help guide me, right? Help me see around corners. So I really, really love being able to lean on folks who have just seen it before. So we have some like really, really awesome early angel investors who have just been there, done that. A guy named Brad Rothenberg. Brad is the CEO and founder of Entopology. And Entop is an awesome, awesome company. And they're like Series
E. What do they do?
They essentially allow you, it's like a generative design software for like parts. They really, without like getting too like deep into the technical, they allow you to design and mesh components for various applications. very, very, very useful software. A lot of incredible teams use Ntop. They're like a Series E company. They're an incredible software. I actually was just asking a guy like what he thought of them, and he was, or I was asking a guy what he thought about them, and like had he heard about them, and he's like, yeah, they're like that new CAD software, right? They're like one of the new big CAD softwares. So like mindshare wise, it is now like up against SOLIDWORKS and we don't talk about Autodesk, but like SOLIDWORKS and NX and Creo. It's like it's a getting there. And that's so exciting. Like, that's awesome. I think CAD software has become overgeneralized. You can design parts and you can design assemblies. And because these softwares, I mean, all of the big CAD companies, their entire business model is M&A. They haven't really built anything new in the past like 10, 15 years.
Really?
So like SOLIDWORKS was an acquisition. Most of their softwares that you like have heard about that you like think is like built by like Dassault or Siemens or PTC, those are acquisitions. Unfortunately, their business, like these businesses basically look like this. It's like sales and distribution and product focus.
So is it kind of like they don't innovate and then as soon as they buy the thing that does innovate, the innovation stops?
Yes. Usually. Great. So really funny story, like piece of lore that like, you know, people know about, it's like public information, but like people don't like realize. It's really funny. The four big CAD companies are PTC, Dassault Systems, Siemens, and Autodesk. Dassault acquired SOLIDWORKS years ago. And so people like assume that like they built it, but like, no, they acquired it from these two guys. They call them the Johns. John McElhaney and, I forgot the other John's last name. John McElhaney and John, other John.
John something.
I'm sorry, John. Yes. Other John. I just know Mac. I haven't met him yet, but he seems really cool. And so they started and sold SOLIDWORKS. They were there for a while and then they left. And then they, I'll get a little bit back to this. There's this company called Onshape. Onshape was also an acquisition. They got acquired by PTC recently. Really, really awesome company. Like all the startups out there use them. They're the first browser-based CAD software. It's supposed to be the SOLIDWORKS killer.
Did they go through YC?
No. I think NEA backed them. Dana from Construct was on their board when she was at NEA. She's awesome. She's really, really great. She's the best. So Onshape was acquired by PTC. PTC also makes Creo. And what's really funny about Onshape is when the Johns were done at SOLIDWORKS, they left and they started Onshape and they sold it to PTC. So like the two main competitive softwares that the Johns have sold to like different companies. It's just a very, very funny like anecdote. Yeah, you could just kind of like do the playbook. So they get it. They really, really get it. They're really, really smart guys. And I look forward to meeting them. Unfortunately, and Onshape is still innovating. I'm really, really happy about that because what ends up happening is like when you get acquired by a big company, politics start getting into play and it becomes like, incentives get disaligned and, decay happens, unfortunately. It has not set in at Onshape, which is really exciting. I know some of the folks there, their head of sales for North America, Chris Steele, he basically took them from like, founder-led sales to their acquisition by PTC, basically. And he's actually helping us with our go-to-market. He's a really good friend. He's actually been helping me figure out, like, I'm an engineer, right? Like, what do I know about sales? Yeah. I've just been, like, doing the hand-to-hand combat myself and figuring it out.
That's actually a really good way to learn it.
Yeah, exactly. So Chris was introduced to me by a guy named Sean Marshall. Sean was the head of sales at Klaviyo and, like, rode with them as they went public. Sean is a beast. Mm-hmm. Sean is such, just a killer in sales. So Sean's been helping us figure stuff out. He actually knew Chris and introduced us to Chris. And Chris in like beginning of January started helping me figure out like our go-to-market like sales motion. Like how do I structure trials? Like how do I do contracts and like sales and stuff like that? From Chris, I see like they are still innovating. They're still killing it. It's really, really awesome to see. But yeah, unfortunately, like writ large, the CAD companies just their incentives are just misaligned. They are sales and distribution machines. They like have a multiple of headcount more sales folks than they do engineering hires, which is unfortunate. Yeah. Unfortunately, like they'll have incredible engineers on staff work for like 4 or 5 years on a project, and then it will just like never get productized, and they get like so disincentivized to like be there anymore that they end up trying to leave. And it's really frustrating. Yeah. It's funny. I used to say this because computational geometry engineers, people who like build CAD kernels and like know how to build like some of these CAD softwares and like these engineering softwares, very, very short supply. And I like to make this joke, like we care so much about, we pay so much attention to the aging out of the American industrial base and manufacturing base. You know, average age of American manufacturing employees in their 50s.
Really?
Yeah. Yes, that's a whole other separate conversation, but yes. So they're going to take all that tribal knowledge with them in the next 5 to 10 years. And the only way we can save American manufacturing is if we are able to aggregate it. And that is what we're after. So that's a whole separate kind of conversation. Yeah, But I like to make this joke that we care so much about the American manufacturing industrial base aging out. We forgot to care about the American computational geometry base aging out. And it's that labor base aging out. I would say from like the folks we've interviewed, roughly like roundabout age of like a real good computational geometry engineer is like at least like their 40s. Like, cause you run into some guys who are like in their like mid 30s. They've been doing it for, you know, they came out of University of Wisconsin with a MEC-E degree and they've been doing it for like 10 years. And you run into some guys who are like 50, 60 still writing the code. And they're so, so smart. Mm-hmm. They're some of the smartest people you ever meet. And they've just been doing the code for like 60 years and they're gonna retire soon. Or they have already retired, or they're still writing the code for fun. But it's like that skill set is so rare, and we're not teaching people in school about computational geometry because like they're like, oh, who cares? We'll just use like Parasolid. It's like, well, yeah, like all these CAD softwares are still built on the same CAD kernels that were created 30 years ago. Yeah, this is a whole rabbit hole to go down, but it's brutal. Yeah. So yeah, these CAD companies are sales and distribution machines, and they will butcher you if you try to go toe to toe with them against like their main products against each other. They're really, really good. Like PTC actually notoriously has like this crazy sales culture. They used to have this. They're trying to get away from it. Mm-hmm. I think they have. This is more of a thing in like the 80s and 90s. PTC effectively like invented 3D CAD software for the most part. I'm pretty sure this story is correct. I could be wrong. But I think for the most part, they invented like 3D CAD software and everything else was 2D. And they ended up like developing a sales culture where they would... their salesmen, like they knew they had like the best thing since sliced bread. Mm-hmm. And so their salespeople would like call somebody, try to convince them to like buy the software. And if they didn't, they would call that person's boss and be like, hey, you should fire that idiot for not buying our software. And it worked a lot of the time. They were like super, super aggressive. And so there's a book out there from Ben Horowitz called A Hard Thing About Hard Things.
Yeah.
He talks about Mark Cranny, who he worked with at Opsware and LoudCloud. And I think he was his head of sales or head of operations. I forgot the specific title, but I think Mark Cranny came from PTC. And I think like that was like the thing. I think PTC is going, you know, you can't really like do that anymore. And also like they're not the only ones with 3D CAD software anymore. So
there's more competition.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, that's actually, I think how... I think that, and this is my own conjecturing, right? I think as a result of that sales culture, you know, Dassault and Siemens like caught up and they had 3D CAD software. And because they were like maybe nice to their customers, they were able to outcompete and capture a lot of like large scale multinational customer base. And so if you look at like aerospace, almost fully captured by Siemens with NX and Teamcenter. And then if you look at like automotive, almost fully captured by 3D Experience and CATIA. And like you'll see some crossover, and a lot of these organizations have like multiple licenses of different like softwares. So, you know, you'll see a lot of crossover, but PTC has lost a lot of upmarket market share to Dassault and Siemens. And I conjecture it might be because of that original sales culture and just like the momentum of having these like suites of software is almost like unrip outable.
Does it work kind of like these companies build something that works really well, and then they start hiring salespeople like crazy because they can sell that thing really well. They can make lots of money, and then they just decide to keep on selling that thing that, and okay, they don't really change.
More or less, you know, people get tied to incentive structures that are more aligned with like hitting quotas. Mm-hmm. You know, we got to hit these numbers to like please the shareholders, and that's like, you know, public company stuff. And you know, companies have to have this balance of like innovation and selling. I think the CAD companies are trying to get it back. They're doing some interesting stuff, but like notoriously, they have a little bit of a tough time with it. Not many people are very happy with a lot of their products, but they just use them because they have to, because there's nothing else out there. So like a lot of people try to innovate, but then they try to penetrate these like impenetrable
fortresses.
Yeah. Like you just...
The moats are very big.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You just like, I really, really am not a huge, anybody selling like MES software is extremely, so MES software, ERP software, any sort of like PLM is incredibly, incredibly tough to sell to any like multinational corporation because they've been penetrated by like Siemens and Dassault, and they've sold them Teamcenter, they've sold them 3D Experience, and they are fully hooked up, and they need that PLM for traceability. So any sort of like legal requirements that they have to tie to like understanding like who did what and when, and like what revision of this model is this, and like who signed off on that, is tied to their PLM. And so you can't like sell PLM software to like Toyota. Like they're not going to buy it because they're like, we can't rip out, are you out of your mind? We can't rip out 3D Experience. We literally have to shut down production. Like, are you crazy? So like I would never, I wouldn't try to like build software like that. We're the way that we see it, like we are like specifically ripping out a process of like using PowerPoint and Word. Like there's no, and what we will do and what we are doing right now is building integrations into those PLMs. So we have a Teamcenter integration cooking. We have a 3D Experience integration cooking so that we can actually integrate and work with large scale enterprises that have expressed a lot of interest in working with us. So, yeah.
What is this company going to look like? So I don't think you've completely given up on your manufacturing aspirations, if I'm correct. What do you think this company is going to look like long term? Am I right about not giving up on your manufacturing aspirations?
I don't usually publicly talk about the 25-year plan.
Give me the 15.
It spooks people. It spooks people. They don't.
If they've stayed this long for the interview, then yeah, that's true. It'll be fine.
My early investors, they told me early on, like, don't talk about the factory. Drop it. Like,
just don't
tell people about. Yeah.
What gets you excited? What ideas get you excited?
So there are interesting applications. What we have with BuilderOS is this core kernel of interesting, of value, that is really that a lot of different people care about how things fit together in the real world and how they come apart. You change 6 lines of code in our software and you don't just get automated assembly instructions, you get automated disassembly instructions. So there's a whole other wide world of market out there for people who need to do maintenance or repair. And we can automatically help them generate those instructions. So, and that's, I can't specify like the name, but like we are working with a really, really awesome company for repair manuals and repair instructions, so like maintenance or repair instructions. Similarly, also can't mention explicitly the name, but you know, like that's an automotive manufacturer, and we have another automotive manufacturer we're working with to do robotic assembly. So ironically, we're back. We're doing robotic assembly again. Super funny. I was speaking at a conference and there were 2 people from this corporation who came up to me, one from that company's automotive team and one from their automation team. And the automotive team was like, you know, they said, yeah, let's talk about doing like a POC for the automated work instructions. And the automation person said, hey, you know what? Like that seems really cool and useful for people. Can you like plug that into a robotic assembly system to help it do assembly planning? And I was like, actually, yeah. We actually built it for that in the first place.
We do that.
So we got the code still. So yeah. So we're cooking something right now that's
gonna be exciting.
It's gonna be exciting. Yeah, well, you know, when I asked them if I could talk about it, and they were like, no, don't, not yet. So when that, there'll be like a thing we'll do to discuss it publicly. But that's, it's really, really cool. Yeah. It's really like not much additional work for us. You know, we basically already built the thing.
Mm-hmm. So just really an application for it.
Kind of thing. Literally just a different output. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like, instead of like output to PDF or output to like the native, we just output it to, a CSV, you know, of, like what order to do the assembly of the parts in and like what paths to follow. Because funny enough, the animations that we automatically generate, those are actually paths for a robotic arm to follow. So, yeah, that was what it was originally for. We actually repurposed the path planning for animations.
Are you going to be working with like Tesla and Boston Dynamics and stuff and like Figure?
No comment.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yes.
Okay. So Tony Stark's your hero from when you were younger.
Still,
now,
to this day. I miss Robert Downey Jr. They shouldn't have killed him off.
Yeah, that is sad. I know.
I know his contract is inspiring. I'm really upset about it, honestly.
I mean, his price tag is quite high. It's like $120 million.
Pay it.
Pay true. It. True. You inspire, people stop going to the movie.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Inspire a whole new generation of builders. I mean, that's where I came from. Like, I saw that and I was like, yeah, let's do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Who's your like favorite historical figure? Who's your favorite historical figure? Like, sometimes I go on, you know, history events and stuff, and I'll just like listen to biographies on like Napoleon and stuff like that. Who's that person for you, and what do you like about them?
Favorite historical figure besides Dirac? Yeah. Let me think about that. I read, so there is, you look at who great men studied. Mm. Napoleon read Caesar. Caesar read Alexander. And who did Alexander read? He read Cyrus. Cyrus the Great. Really, really interesting guy. There's a book written about him called the Cyropedia. Highly recommend reading it. What I learned from that was that the best way to build something meaningful and long-lasting is to build up the people around you and fill them with both autonomy, agency, and wealth. And the real wealth that you can build is by bringing up others around you. And that is something that I very, very heavily lead my life by. So I found that really interesting. There are a lot of really interesting historical figures that I admire. But Cyrus the Great, very, very like close to the top.
It's one that I haven't heard of before, which is good.
So, yeah, I mean, look, they call him the Great for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Funny enough, he's also, I think, the only person in the Old Testament that is referenced as like messianic in like the context of he's referenced as a prophet. Mm-hmm. He's very, very like lauded in the Old Testament because he's the only he pardoned and like basically gave the kingdom of Judea like its land, like an autonomy. I think I might be like butchering that a little bit, but like he is like viewed by the Old Testament as like the only like non-Jew that's like a prophet effectively, which is kind of interesting. Yeah, he's great. Like that's just like leading with benevolence, leading with putting other people first and building other people up. And I very highly value that.
Yeah, I love that so much because it's all about like, it all goes back to like incentives. And if you incentivize good behavior, if you incentivize people building things, stuff like that, if you build people up, like when you look at Elon, he doesn't typically say, I did it all. You know, he's constantly talking about, we have an amazing engineering team. We have an amazing manufacturing team, all this stuff, you know, our engineers at SpaceX are changing the world, whatever.
Yep.
That's a very, totally very similar thing.
Like our team is incredible. So I'll tell you some more about my team. It's myself, Peter, and four engineers.
Yeah.
We've got Jared, Sam, Keenan, and Vatsal. Two front end, two back end. What's funny about that is like, they're all just doing multidisciplinary stuff. They're all like front end and back end, but like everybody's kind of doing everything and even some non-technical stuff too. So Jared is actually flexing into product. He's probably going to be doing that like full time later on as we start to like bring more people onto the team. And he's such a killer at it. He's got it. I love seeing him like talk to people. He's so articulate and friendly and just great at it. So I'll tell you a little bit more about the front end team. And like this is also kind of like leans into how great they are for mm-hmm. the team. They just like know and care. So Keenan was the first guy that came out of the team. He was a manufacturing engineer over at Boeing. He was in their Renton and Everett facilities working on 777s. He was a manufacturing engineer, drafted work instructions a bunch. And then he found out he had a knack for software, taught himself how to code, pivoted internally, and then wrote software for their manufacturing engineering team for 4 years, and then came and joined us. Jared was a manufacturing engineer over at this company called Hubble Power Systems. They make transformers down in Georgia. And then he was a senior nuclear engineer over at General Dynamics Electric Boat. So it's like the only civilian like person, type of person that takes the Navy officer exam. So he like manned a Virginia class sub. He's an awesome guy. And then he taught himself how to code entirely himself. Then he worked at this company called Cengage to make textbook software. And then he came and joined us. Yeah, it's funny. Like we had a job posting that just closed. And yeah. He messaged me on LinkedIn. He was like, hey, like I know the posting's closed, but I'd love to chat anyway. And I was like,
sure.
I like that. I appreciate that. Yeah. So we chatted and he just like, right off the bat, was just so enthusiastic. Same with Keenan. So enthusiastic. And right off the bat, I was like, yes. Jared and Keenan are both the front end guys. Sam and Vatsa are both the back end guys. So Sam's working on computational geometry. He's got a robotics background with hardware and software. Such like... insane, probably like just so insanely smart.
Mm-hmm.
God, we're
very. That seems like a very constant theme where you're like surrounding yourself with extremely intelligent individuals and hardworking
as
well.
Yes. I would not rather have it any other way. And then Vatsal, incredible, incredible engineer, super, super funny, super friendly. He's our ML engineer. He's working on this problem right now. It's like not an ML problem. He just came on and it was like, sorry, Vatsal, but like we've got this thing for you. We call it inheritance. It's a very, very cool problem of like geometric inheritance of like if you upload a CAD file that's like, let's say you like diff two models. You know, we're not in SOLIDWORKS, right? How do I take a step file as an input, have one version of it, and let's say I upload a second version with like two parts removed, two parts added, and how do I have a system understand that these are the same model and like this part corresponds to that part and this part corresponds to that part? That's the problem we call inheritance. Mm. Very difficult, but Vatsal solved it. So that's been something we've been cooking for months and we're very, very excited for that actually to get onto the platform. It's going to be it's going to save a lot of time. It's sort of like this, there's an aspect of like geometric fingerprinting that like we have like
incorporated. What is geometric fingerprinting?
Understanding based on various like geometric properties of a model, like how to identify something. So like looking at like a combination of surface area, volume, axes of inertia, moment of inertia, axes of the moment of inertia, like a variety of like geometric primitives, mm-hmm. like native to the file or native to the part. And like where is its center of mass, moment of inertia, and just like a variety of other things as well that we are like, you know, don't want to share too much specifics, but like things that you can in combination have as like attributes and like numerics that can uniquely identify a part without like doing an overlap of meshes and saying like, they're roughly. Yeah. So a couple of like statistics, a couple of numbers that we can like use to say this is exactly this part in this database. So that in combination with a couple of other methods is like how we are able to do inheritance. Couple of like very, very cool things that will also play into how we simulate. So we don't have to like re-simulate when they're like the entire assembly simulation if there's just like one or two parts diffed. I can go on about that. But
how often do you come across a problem that's like extremely difficult and you don't even necessarily know if it's like solvable and then you just give it to your team and they do it?
Basically all the time. I just trust the team. They're great. I'm like pretty consistently, look, Peter, like, just, you know, figure it out. Like, I should, I mean, inheritance was that, honestly.
That's what it was.
No idea. Okay. I was just like, Votsel,
good luck.
Well, welcome to the team. Yes, here you go.
Get it done.
Literally, like, within the first, like, we had been wanting to work on inheritance for, like, a month or two, and then we brought Votsel on, and he was, like, an ML guy. He actually, it's so awesome. Votsel joined us the day he got his U.S. citizenship. So it's awesome. Yeah. Like, and he moved and joined us like literally 7 days later. He just came and just like that. Yeah. It's, he's such a killer. So yeah, I was just like, yeah. So, welcome to the team. Here's inheritance. Figure it out. And we, you know, obviously he and I like coordinate a lot on it. I'm like a thought partner for him on like, how do we like think about this? And Peter like is very much so as well. I like to stay very actively involved in like product, roadmap and like architecturally speaking, like what is to be built and where and why and how and in what way. I would like to stay as close to that as much as possible, for a long time. Yeah. It's very important to me. And I also enjoy it a lot. Like I, you know, yeah.
It sounds like a whole bunch of problems that you just get to tackle constantly.
Yeah, it's awesome. I love life. There's literally nothing I would rather be doing than this.
It just invigorates you?
Nothing. Yeah. I was actually talking to a friend who works at Augustus's company. Schultz, he's awesome. He's an amazing engineer. And we're talking about how, like, yeah, I don't think if anybody, there's not a single person on the planet who, if they offered me, like, you know, I don't know, some crazy percentage of a company to come and join them, I wouldn't drop anything. I would not stop working on Dirac for literally anybody. If Elon was like, Phil, I want to give you, you know, 25% of SpaceX, you know, and come and like run the company, I'd be like,
that'd be a very hard offer to turn down.
That would be a very hard offer.
I mean,
to
I don't
down.
Know. we got to run that.
It'd be a hard offer to turn down, but there are problems where.
Point being, the mission is like important to you.
I just, it's funny, like at home, I have like a work area, and if you look behind me, like if we're on Zoom and you look behind me, you'll see two things. You'll see an IKEA desk with a bunch of Legos on top of it, like a bunch of like fully, but like all the space Legos. So like I got a Saturn V rocket, I've got an ISS, I've got a lunar lander, I got a shuttle. And they're all on this IKEA desk. And you look back at that and you're like, huh. Yeah, Dirac is called the assembly company. It's kind of for a reason. I guess I've like, you know,
you got founder, something in deep in your personality and your
founder problem fit. I just love putting parts together.
And now taking them apart for a very good margin.
I mean, we help people put them together for a good margin.
What's the most difficult thing? This is the final question. What's the most difficult thing you've ever had to overcome?
It's a good question. Sometimes I get in my own way. Building a company, I've realized, is frequently a battle against. It's a battle against how you think about yourself and the world, and. You know, like overcoming, like overcoming preconceived notions about certain things, especially if you were like, I'm a stubborn person. And like, I love talking to people. I have this, like, I will never say no to a conversation. Like you text me, you DM me, I'll talk to you. It's actually a problem. Like, you know, I will keep conversations running like long, all the time. Like just, I'm makes me prime for podcasts. Like yes. I can kind of just ramble. There's a certain aspect of that, that like I've needed to unlearn, or I'm still working on this. Right. Where like viscerally, like people kind of just don't care. And that's kind of like hard for me. Like I get very, very excited about stuff, and like I want to share. Like I love getting into things. I love like talking, and you know, a lot of people like don't want to hear like the whole, thing.
Yeah,
people like just don't want to hear. Like when I tell a story, as you can kind of tell now, I go off on like side quests and I get into like tangents, which I love doing. But a lot of the times people don't even care about the story. They just want to hear the beginning and the end, and they just want like the spark notes. And for me, that's like, I don't like that. Like, I get it. But like, that's been, you know, personally, I've had to like overcome that and like figure out, just like strategies about like the better way to like talk about stuff and like, you know, refine the way that I think about conversations and just like get the reps in. So the toughest, that's one of the tougher things to overcome. It's just like understanding. I like to be, I like to very much consider myself like coachable. I love to just like learn from people about how to like improve. And it's very important to me to like to be constantly improving. If I am the same person that I was 3 months ago, I'm doing something horrifically wrong. And I very much like pride myself on being a constantly changing, constantly improving person. And so some of the difficult things I've had to overcome, I would say among the hardest, are trying to find the right people to learn from. This kind of goes back to like fundraising and like who, yeah, like what investors to work with. Like, I very much want to work with people who I can learn from, who I can learn a lot from about how to be the best version of myself. And it's tough to find those people. And
yeah,
so that's one aspect of it. Similarly, you know, stuff like with the factory, right? Like I pitched. And I, now that we're sort of like over this hump, I don't mind sharing a bit, but like I was very embarrassed about like that. I felt like that was a very deep personal failure that I was not. I tried to raise money for the factory, right? Tried to raise venture capital, yeah, for the factory. I spent like 6 months. I pitched 300 VCs in 6 months on the factory.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And you know, it's fine. It's funny. Some of those investors who I pitched on the factory are now investors in, yeah, Direct today. So like no hard feelings whatsoever. But you know, like that sucked. That sucked a lot.
Cause it's like, it felt, I imagine it felt like a personal failing.
Yeah.
Even if it isn't,
it's just, I wish more people got it. Because it still makes sense and there's still a way to win. Just might not just be venture capital. But I wish more people saw the world the way that I do. And the way that I live my life and a constant thing I'm trying to do is help people understand that just a little bit better, to like share and help, like, you know, put my glasses on, like share how I see the world. Like, I am relentlessly optimistic that the world might be not so great today. It's you know, the world is wonderful. The world is better than it's ever been, but it can be better. It can be so much better. And all you have to do is choose to make it better. You can have agency. You can have autonomy. You can just do things. You don't have, yeah, to ask people for like permission. You can just build. You can just do things. That's, I think, what a lot of like the El Segundo movement is about. Just not asking people if it's okay to build hard things, just going and doing it. And that's why I love these guys.
I saw a tweet from Zane Mountcastle a few weeks ago where he said, people don't realize that you can just like buy a warehouse and then, you know, buy a bunch of materials and just start, yep, making shit. And you can.
Yeah. Zane's a very, very good friend. Like, he's right. Zane, by the way, he's super humble.
Yeah.
Literally a pre-seed hardware company, and they're profitable.
I know.
Crazy. Like, his margins, he won't tell you this, but they're quite high for a hardware company.
Yeah, I got that. You know, I interviewed him, and
like
I got
80%
that.
Plus, like more, there's well, like more than 80%.
Zane, thank you. Yeah. We like you. I'm not trying to put him on gas.
No, I'm saying like he's like his margins are 80%.
Oh, I know. What's your saying? No, like operating? Like, yeah, the operating margin?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
That's what I'm saying.
Well, yeah, no, That's why, yeah. So I talked to them a little bit, and he was talking about basically doing a fixed price model instead of cost plus.
I mean, that's what
allows for is you basically say, I can deliver this at X price, and if people are willing to pay that price, then you've got a business.
Yes, you know, literally. Yeah, that's how businesses work. Cost plus is an abomination. Cost plus is why I left Northrop.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't like it because of the incentives. I don't think that misaligned incentives are not good, and especially if you're not spending your money, spending other people's money.
Destroyed cultures are downstream of misaligned incentives.
Yep.
So like what I saw when I was at Northrop was everybody came in like 11 to 3 roughly, and that's maybe not so fair. It was like more like 10 to 4. Mm. And I, you know, every other day they were in the office. And I was just working. I had a mentor there and I was working with him, and I just kind of like, I guess I like took a step back one day when I was working with him, and I looked at him and I was like, he'd been there for like 30 years. You know, he was only in on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Mm. And I was just kind of like, if I stick around here,
do I want to become that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was such a nice guy, but like, I don't want to turn into that. Yeah. Where like, I just don't care anymore. I'm physically the shape of my seat. I have like, you know, yeah. And I just kind of was like, I got to get out of here. So that was happening at the same time as when Peter and I were reading the Foundation series. It was at the same time as me starting to think about this stuff. And I was like,
you get to see the contrast between like, you know, this idea, this story, and the reality of your like day to day.
Yeah. So I was like
taking a different direction.
Exactly. So I was like, you know what? There's room to do something different. And I've always wanted to, I mean, honestly, it's also just being a tiny cog in a huge machine. You know, like I got TS clearance when I was at Northrop. They actually got it for me when I was 19, which is crazy. Yeah. Like it's because all of their guys with TS were aging out. And so they wanted to like grab a couple of folks from like, you know, early cohort. It took me, for the record, I was not at Northrop for very long. I was there for a 3-month internship between sophomore and junior year. And then again, between junior and senior year. And also like for the co-op, like a little bit after that. And they gave me a return offer. They spent, to get me TS clearance, it took, you know, I was 19. They had to like do a background check and stuff. But like, I hadn't done anything. They asked me like, oh, why did you go to Costa Rica when you were like 14? Mm. So I was like, I don't know. It was for a week or two. I don't remember. It's like, it doesn't really matter. But that was it. Normally, like, it takes people like 2 years or 3 years to get TS. It took me like 6 months.
You got expedited.
Yeah, I'm just like, what are they going to... They talked to my parents. They talked to some roommates in college. Just like...
He's not a terrorist.
Yeah, I'm just like, clean slate, right? Like, what am I... I've literally, like, barely ever been out of the country, right? It's super easy to do background check on me. And they spent... I think it was actually probably closer to 9 months. They spent more time getting me TS clearance than the time I actually spent there. And they spent more money sponsoring my TS clearance than they offered me yearly salary in my return offer. With like a master's. And I was like, guys, this is like brutal. This is brutal. This is so silly. Right. Exactly. Yeah. You're that look.
That makes no sense.
Yeah, I know. To me, I know. But and you wonder.
How much does it cost? Is that like more? I would imagine more than 120.
They didn't offer me 120.
Well, yeah. Oh, okay. Really?
They offered me 90.
Huh. That's not much.
No. I had a master's in robotics and a bachelor's in EE. And they were like, yep.
Is that with stock or no?
No stock.
No, it's just 90 base?
It was like 91. Yeah. Yeah, I was like, you know, guys, yeah. And they paid for my TS. Why would they? Yeah. So again, incentive structures, right? Like what? Something. And I was just so hungry to work on a hard thing there. And I kept asking people, hey, can you like give me more work? Can you give me more work? Can you give me work? They gave me a project there that they said would have taken me, it was supposed to take me 3 months for an internship. I finished it in 3 days. And I was like, can you give me more work? Can you give me more work? Can you give me more work? I went to a senior EE and he had like some board. They initially had me on like some like design, not design. They had me on like some test work They wanted me to like do some tests, write like some scripts, some MATLAB scripts to test. And they basically, I finished that in like a day because it's like, it's MATLAB, it's not hard. And I found this senior EE and I was like, hey, like, can I like do some design work? Can you just give me some work? So he just like offloaded a whole like PCB design project to me. And so like I got to work on, and like this I can't like specify too much about, but I got to work on some pretty cool like radar like board design stuff. Mm. And that was really cool. But like, and I finished that pretty quick too. It was before the end of my internship. And I just kept trying to hunt for like interesting work to do. I really wanted to work in the space systems team. Yeah. Just wanted to work on like a hard problem. And they wouldn't give me a hard problem. They wouldn't like let me throw my energy at something. And like, that's the problem. Like, that's what SpaceX and Anduril like fix, is they can let people who are young and hungry throw themselves at something and just let them figure it out. And like, that's what I wanted to do. And they wouldn't let me do it. Like,
and so you just had to leave.
Yeah, I had to get out of there.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, thank you so much, Phil. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for having me, man.